So I guess it's time to begin, and I had planned on starting with a poem before the guided meditation, but I forgot. So I'm going to read the poem first before I talk about our topic today. The poem is a good one to introduce the topic. So this poem is called Mind Wanting More by Holly Hughes. Only a beige slat of sun above the horizon, like a shade pulled not quite down. Otherwise, clouds. Sea rippled here and there. Birds reluctant to fly. The mind wants a shaft of sun to stir the gray porridge of clouds. An osprey to stitch sea to sky. With its barred wings, some dramatic music, a symphony, perhaps, a Chinese gong. But the mind always wants more than it has. One more bright day of sun, one more clear night in bed with the moon, one more hour to get the words right. One more chance for the heart in hiding to emerge from its thicket in dried grasses. As if this quiet day with its tentative light weren't enough, as if joy weren't strewn all around. So, our topic this month is clinging, the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. Before I begin with the talk on the second noble truth, I'm going to review the three insights of the first noble truth and introduce the three insights of the second noble truth. As you might remember, if you've listened to the talks in January, our talks last month, the focus was on the Four Noble Truths and the 12 Insights. That's the topic for the year at SIMS. And each truth involves three insights. So Four Noble Truths times three equals 12 insights. You can see these insights listed on the SIMS website. And a way you find them is you go to practice on the homepage, and I'll write this in the chat. But you go to practice on the homepage, you click on Annual Teaching Series, and that has a drop-down menu, and then there's the Four Noble Truths and 12 Insights 2025. Below that, you'll also find the resources for our talks this month or this year. So just to background, I'm going to tell you right now what the insights are that we are focusing on so far. So, the insights for the first noble truth. Let's see, when did I write that? Oh, yeah. The insights for the first noble truth, which is there is suffering, is the first insight is there is suffering. The second insight is suffering should be understood. And the third insight is suffering has been understood. The insights for the second noble truth are the origin of suffering is craving. And the fifth insight is craving should be abandoned. And the sixth insight is craving has been abandoned. I've been asking myself why these insights are important, why they're an important part of our practice. I'm going to find my notes on my screen here so I don't have to look down at a piece of paper. Just one second. Why is this about the insights and the Four Noble Truths? Why do we need these insights? When I first started learning about the Four Noble Truths, the insights seemed pretty simple, maybe even so obvious as to be unnecessary. You know, the origin of suffering is craving. Craving should be abandoned. Craving has been abandoned. So why do we have to have these? This time around, I think I'm appreciating them more. I think they're important because this is, as Jack Kornfield says, a path with heart based on a deep wisdom that involves ahipassako, the Buddha's direction that we have to see for ourselves. Our seeing or understanding has to be grounded in the citta, and the citta is the heart mind. And it has to be grounded with a knowing that goes beyond analytical conceptual thinking. It has to include a penetrating wisdom that incorporates the felt sense of experience. Or as Philip Moffat says, with respect to suffering, we have to experience the ouch of suffering. If we want to get to cessation, we have to go way beyond recognition. So we start with recognition. There is suffering. Craving is the origin of suffering. We have to recognize that. We have to check it out. We have to say, is that so? So we start with recognition. That's one step, and this is a process. So the first step, recognition, is something like, I get this idea. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I like it. Yeah, I agree. That's how I reacted when I first started listening to our founder, Rodney Smith's Dharma Talks, and reading my first books by Joseph Goldstein. But then I wanted to know more. I was curious. These ideas were interesting, and I didn't really totally understand them. I liked them, but I didn't understand them. So I followed with some questions like, how do they relate to me and my experience? Or more importantly, if this is true, how can it help relieve my suffering? So if there is suffering, how can that help relieve it? And if craving is the origin of suffering, how does that help me relieve my suffering? The insights are important because they are the cause-effect links that lead from ignorance, from greed, hatred, and delusion, from suffering to nibbana. And it's the cumulative wisdom of the insights, not our willpower of the ego, that propels us along our path. So, the suffering of craving. The second noble truth is a natural development of our practice with the first noble truth. It takes us deeper into our understanding of suffering and ultimately to the end of suffering. We're asked to recognize suffering's craving nature and to contemplate the possibility that no craving, no suffering might be a truth. The second noble truth involves paying attention to the arising and ceasing of craving, to the felt sense of these states. And from now on, I'm going to use the terms craving, clinging, and grasping interchangeably. I like the terms clinging and grasping because they offer a visual image and also a tactile sense. They're more descriptive to me than craving and help me get a sense of the contraction, the uncomfortable squeezing feeling of craving, and the way it limits space, choice, relaxation, and freedom. The Buddha said, he who understands clinging and non-clinging understands all the Dharma. So that's a pretty big statement. He who understands clinging and non-clinging understands all the Dharma. I don't know where the Buddha said that, but I found it in quotes in Philip Moffat's book, Dancing with Life, on page 90. And I'll talk more about this idea when I talk later about the five aggregates of clinging. As we practice the second noble truth, we're learning to look for the connection between craving and suffering, and we're learning to let go. The fourth, fifth, and sixth insights of the second noble truth have a cause-effect connection, as I said before, Understanding why craving should be abandoned will lead to the actual act of abandoning. We can only know for sure that craving should be abandoned through our direct, observed, and felt experience of craving. When we see and know that it is a danger to us and to others, and that it doesn't lead to happiness, then letting go can happen. But it seems counterintuitive that letting go of what we want could lead to happiness. We have a lot of unlearning to do. Just because we desired, but I just want to put this in, just because we desire doesn't mean we crave. So I want to add that. It's not all desire, not all desire is craving. Desire is a natural human impulse, and there are a lot of pleasant experiences in the world for us to desire and enjoy. There are also altruistic aspirations that are of great benefit to all beings. It is the grasping of desire that causes suffering. Philip Moffat gives an example of the difference in Dancing with Life. He says, you don't have to crave something just because you like it. Your mind can rest easy in the presence of what is attractive. He goes on to describe how when the Dalai Lama was offered refreshment at a conference, the Dalai Lama shared in an interview afterward, they kept giving me cheese and what I really wanted was the fruitcake. And then he just laughed and laughed and laughed. Philip goes on to say that if desire doesn't have control over us, we don't have to judge it or fear it. And that's the situation with the Dalai Lama. Craving, or tanha, meaning thirst in Pali, has an insatiable, out of control, never enough quality to it. When we focus on the object of our desire, believing our happiness depends on it, we are moving into clinging. We create expectations and fantasies around the object that are in conflict with reality and will inevitably lead to disappointment and suffering. The three basic kinds of clinging, which will help us recognize craving in ourselves, are one, craving for the objects of the six senses. So sights and sounds and tastes and sensations and smells and thoughts and emotions. Those are, the mind is considered a sense. Craving to become is the second kind of craving. And that is an example, is to become what we are not, or to achieve more, or accumulate more, to be successful, to be competent, to be praised, to be important, or even to become a good meditator. Then there's craving for non-being, or getting rid of. We might want to get rid of aspects of ourselves that we don't like, that we're ashamed of, or to avoid painful physical experiences or painful emotional experiences, such as being blamed or criticized. And if we're too overwhelmed, we might even crave total escape and death. The connection between clinging and our views about happiness seems to be important. It seems like the Four Noble Truths are telling us that our happiness will come from aligning ourselves with the reality of the way things are. According to the Buddha, that would mean aligning ourselves with the truth of the three characteristics of all conditioned phenomena. And that would be anicca, dukkha, anatta, or as Ruth King says in her book, I found it in her book, Mindful of Race, and I like it. I use it more than anicca, dukkha, and anatta, but these three characteristics, she calls them impermanent, imperfect, impersonal. And that's very helpful to me when I find myself attached to something, grasping and clinging. It reminds me, oops, there's a danger here. We grasp because we're deluded and think that we can permanently be happy and satisfied. And the grasping comes from the inherent insecurity and dissonance with what's true. Ajahn Sumedho says, once there is seeing in the right way, there's no more suffering. We can see a desire just as a desire, even when we find ourselves attached to the desire, there's just the attachment. We don't want to add anything to it. We don't want to say it has been there forever or that it will continue forever. We don't need to personalize it and identify with it. We don't need to perfect it by making it more than it is. Like, this is the worst thing. This is the end of the world. But we have to learn for ourselves how to let go by practicing again and again and letting go of little and big things in our life. This enables us to move from reacting to responding and from seeing with judgment to seeing with calm clarity. And this is how we disentangle from desire. It's a process. As Ajahn Sumedho says, at first you let go, but then you pick it up again because the habit of grasping is so strong. Practice and non-judging lead to sustaining non-attachment. Not, this shouldn't be like this, but this is just the way it is. One of my first practices with conscious letting go was way at the beginning of my time starting practice. And it was very simple, and I'm sure many of you have experienced the same thing, but it had an impact. And this was the experience of not scratching the itch while meditating. I felt the desire to relieve the unpleasantness of the itch. And normally I would just have scratched it, but I had been instructed not to move. So letting go of my aversion to the unpleasantness of the itch sensation allowed me to see that unpleasantness was impermanent. My attachment stayed with the sensation, and I watched it, and I saw it passed away. So that was Ahipasako, one of my first experiences of seeing for myself. But it was an insight that later helped me experiment with craving for some unhealthy food. I thought, I won't go for the gratification right away. I'll see if this craving is impermanent or if it will pass away like the itch. So even though at that moment I was imagining the great satisfaction I would feel when I took a bite into that sugary donut delight, I drove past the donut shop. And a few minutes down the road, I had forgotten about the donut for a moment and my craving. And it was just enough time for me to assess the drawbacks of satisfying my craving and the advantages of letting go of my craving. So it's pretty simple, and I think we've all experienced something like that. But it was just like a beginning. Oh, you know, renunciation. There's a happiness of satisfying the pleasure, and there's a happiness of renunciation. Another example of clinging that has had a lot of, I got insight from, many years ago before I practiced Buddhism back in the 70s, there was a time when I was not very happy. I didn't like where I was living and I didn't like my job. And I felt like I didn't have anything to look forward to and I wanted to fix it. One of my favorite cravings at the time, I now see in retrospect, was the craving to become. I loved to daydream about great things I could do or be in the future. And in a flash, I thought, I know I will save my money for 3 years and then I'll quit my job and travel around Europe for a year. That was something I could really look forward to and would take my mind off my dissatisfaction with my daily life. I could spend a lot of time planning and imagining the wonderful experiences I was going to have at the end of 3 years. I began putting my plan into action. And 3 years later, I gave notice and began the final preparations. It was true that the plan had brought me a lot of pleasure over the 3 years. And my daydreams had definitely made my dissatisfaction with my current situation tolerable. One of my preparations before I left for Europe was to take a short trip to Santa Barbara to say goodbye to a good friend. I'd never been to Santa Barbara or to anywhere in Southern California. In fact, I hadn't traveled much at all. So even this trip held a kind of exotic allure. It was summer, my friend and I had no responsibilities, I had just quit my job, and the future was all possibility. I remember parking the car and preparing to go in to meet my friend for lunch, when I was suddenly overcome by a wave of emotion. Oh my, this is it, I thought. This is what I was looking forward to, and it's just my life. There's no magic transformation. This is what my trip to Europe will be like, too. I had this sinking realization. Happily ever after might not exist. When I look back with my Dhamma eye, I think this was a moment of disenchantment and very necessary. Joseph Goldstein says that the Buddha speaks of disenchantment as a precursor to awakening because we need to wake up from our dreamlike state of ignorance. For me, this was not the first enchantment I had created for myself or the last. We let go and then we pick it up again because the habit of grasping is so strong. Our ignorance of the three characteristics of all conditioned phenomena is strong too. So that non-permanent, not perfect, not personal, you know, we keep picking it up again, at least I do. And instead of aligning our understanding of experience with permanence, perfection, and I being mine, we need to see ourselves and all experience as part of nature, governed by the natural laws of the way things are. Not permanent, not perfect, not personal. Which brings me to the five clinging aggregates, which is the last topic that I want to touch on this morning. The five clinging aggregates, the Buddha included them in his first discourse on the Four Noble Truths, and so they have to be important to our practice. But I admit that I have avoided them. The term aggregate has been a distraction. I can't relate to it, and maybe some of you feel that way. But I've been curious, what are these five important things and why are they important? So I've been listening to some talks by Mark Nunberg and reading on the topic in Bhikkhu Bodhi's new book, which was recommended by Mark Nunberg, Noble Truths, Noble Path, and it's published in 2023. So it's one of his newer publications. Both Mark Nunberg and Bhikkhu Bodhi are longtime Theravada teachers whom I have a lot of respect for. Mark is the guiding teacher of Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis and has been teaching since 1993. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American Buddhist monk who was ordained in 1973 in Sri Lanka. He's translated, written, or published many books on the Buddha's teachings. So with the help of these two teachers, I began to understand what these things or aggregates are and why they're important. And that's what I want to close with. Mark Nunberg said these aggregates or things are the activities of the mind and body that make up all of our experience. That's really helpful to me. Okay, they're activities, they're human activities, and they're the basic ones. Bhikkhu Bodhi says there are five groups into which the Buddha classified the content of human experience. The five are material form, which Mark calls activities of the body, and feeling, perception, volitional activities, but I like Mark Nunberg's term, mental fabrications, better, and sense door consciousness. So that would be eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness. So Mark Nunberg puts them into two categories. These activities are mind activities or body activities. And so the mind activities are, again, feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, perception, mental fabrications, and consciousness, sense consciousness. The Buddha offers these categories to us as a tool to help us deconstruct what Mark calls the spell of conventional reality. With these five categories, the Buddha is offering us a way to see how, in this fathom-long body, we add a layer to our bare experience, which causes stress. Paying attention to these five things, body, feeling, tone, perception, mental fabrications, sense consciousness, helps us see how clinging arises. Bhikkhu Bodhi says the five aggregates comprise all the things we most intimately take to be mine. They are the objects on which we impute the innate sense of I and the way we define ourself. Some of you may be familiar with the lump of foam discourse in which the Buddha compares each aggregate respectively to a lump of foam, a water bubble, a mirage, a hollow plantain tree trunk, and a magical illusion. By doing this, he's pointing out that each of these things we cling to is empty or unsubstantial. And it reminds me of how I felt when my daydream about my escape to Europe dissolved, when I saw how unsubstantial it was. With respect to the five aggregates, the Buddha said, "Before I was enlightened, I thought, what is the enjoyment? So he thought, what is the enjoyment in this thing, this body, this perception, this fabrication, this consciousness, this eye consciousness or ear consciousness? And then I thought, what is the danger? And then I thought, what is the escape? Whatever we crave binds our heart, and we need to keep craving from being renewed. The mind is caught, and then there is disenchantment, and craving is not renewed." So that's kind of the process that Mark Nunberg was describing, that the mind is caught, and then there's disenchantment. And what comprises disenchantment, according to the Buddha, is asking, what gratification is there in this? What is this gratification? So it's a process. What is the danger in this? And what is the escape? And the Buddha said, remember, he said, he who understands clinging and non-clinging understands all the Dharma. And going along with that, he said, "When I truly knew enjoyment as enjoyment, danger as danger, and escape as escape, then I claimed enlightenment." So, the five aggregates, those five things of our experience, can be helpful. And I, you know, I'm just starting to, I'm on the very first inside of trying to just recognize what are these things. And it is a process to experience them. So it's not something that's going to happen overnight. And we have craving, and we want to stop renewing craving. So we shouldn't judge craving, because that's an attachment. So just recognizing it and trying to understand, what am I getting from this? What are the dangers in this? And what is the escape? So I'll leave you with those questions to think about as we go into our breakout groups. Clinging is not an easy practice, and non-clinging, but I think it's, from what I've understood, it's pretty important. So if you would like to stay and talk with a Sangha person, have a discussion, this is the time to stay. And if you need to leave, this would be a time to leave so I can put the groups together. The questions I'm going to ask are, just suggest, you don't have to do these. What desires or aspirations do you recognize as wholesome in yourself? And which of the three types of cravings do you recognize in yourself? And those three types, again, are desire for a sense pleasure, desire for becoming, desire for non-becoming or getting rid of. And if you want to, you could talk about the enjoyment in them, the dangers or drawbacks, and the ways to escape. So just some thoughts on clinging, but you can really talk about anything you'd like. I want to remind you of the guidelines in the breakout groups to respect anonymity, to let give enough time for each person to participate, and to listen with interest and respect. And yeah, those are the basic ones. Looks like everybody is back. So if you'd like to share, we have a few minutes. You might share what you talked about or anything else. Judith.
Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to thank you for so clearly giving the website link to the yearly teaching focus page and the resources. I really appreciated that. And I also was really relating to what you said about your planning your big trip to Europe. Because when I was planning to move to Quebec, it was kind of this similar thing, and I was escaping all of these problems and going to this big new life. And when I actually left, of course, I was full of various emotions, sadness, leaving my family and friends, and sheer terror because I was moving to another country and going to work in my second language, but also excitement. And after the first day, I was driving through Canada, and I realized, well, I'm just driving through Canada, and I'm just thinking about keeping gas in my car, and where am I going to stay, and eating, and how quickly my big adventure turned into routine.
Mm-hmm.
It's life. It's just life. Yeah.
So you never did that again. You never got excited. I'm being facetious. Because usually we pick it up again.
Oh yeah, no, it's not like it never happened again. No.
Yeah.
But I don't think it happened on quite that scale.
Right.
Yeah.
I hear you. Gisela.
Beautiful. You said it lovely, Lauren. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. I'm starting to understand the structure of this. I really identified with both yours and Judith's story. I have had an amazing life of really fantastic, bombastic things. And I am settling now into something quite the opposite, but also very important to me and to my extended family. So you've given me a lot to think about, because one of my assignments from another engagement I have is to figure out how to turn the next 5 years into the same bombastic feeling I had when I got off the plane at some location when I was 23. And I'm like, after hearing you talk, after hearing Judith talk, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go back there, because it is very bombastic and it is very fulfilling. But it is that same clinging pleasure, like scrape, 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 scrape. And it's great fun. I always said that my favorite place to be is in my mind, but it's great when it's happy, but it's not so good when it's not happy. So it's like a balance of the two. So thanks for sharing, and thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. Anyone else want to share about your wholesome desires or clinging? Suze?
We got into the big wholesome, the big, big wholesome desire to keep living.
Mm.
And all of what's involved in that. And clinging to life and what we learn from it. And I said that there are two, I think, wholesome things that come out of my loving life is gratitude and more dedication to practice, so that as my life ends, I'll still be awake to it. And how do I be awake to it if I'm not continuing to practice with this is the way it is right now, this is the way it is right now, this is the way it is right now. So we went big and bow to my small group people, really a lot of wisdom.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Big is important, especially as you're aging, because that came up for me a lot too when I was thinking about this. Yeah. We have about another minute if anybody else would like to share. Liz, go ahead.
This was perfect this week. My dad fell sick last week, and I rushed up to Canada to go be with my family. He was in the hospital until yesterday, and I didn't mention this with my group, but it was definitely, I was very grateful for practice because I witnessed my own clinging of not wanting to see this change, not only for him, but for my mom. Mm-hmm. And I also witnessed the different clinging. My dad has been, I think he has been sick for a while, but they're often stubborn. And he has more of a, I feel like, an acceptance of where he's at. My mom is still very much trying to push to be in a place. And it was a deep travel and strong use of my and I was grateful in a way for the experience of it as much as it sucked. And I appreciated, I actually was listening to, I've listened to your previous podcast of yours, actually, Lauren, because it was one I had missed, and it was about dukkha, and I was able to label the dukkha, the dukkha, the dukkha. Very grateful for the practice. I have this future ideal at some point of some sort of goal where I'll be more at peace. And it's also, that's exciting too, because I know it's all a journey. In my group, one of my group members had a quote, and I can't remember what it was. I was trying to write it down, and it's already gone. But yeah, it's... yeah, I'm very thankful for Sangha and very thankful for you all this week, and the path continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz, so much for sharing. And Christy, you wanted to share something?
Yes, I hope this isn't crosstalk, but and thank you, Lauren, for your talk. But Gisela was speaking and used the word bombastic. And it was one of those times where my aging mind went, I think I know what it means. But I thought I would read the definition. I hope this doesn't hurt your feelings, Gisela, if I tell you what it says. Forceful and confident in a way that is tended to be very powerful and impressive, but may not have much real meaning or effect. And I thought, oh, boy, that's a hard one. I wondered if you identified with that. But
if I can comment, it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think you can ask people questions if you're for clarity. That's my experience. Is that, well, we'll talk about it as far as, because we do want to respect not cross-talking. So maybe we'll follow up with that next time. Thank you, everyone. I just want to remind you that you can offer Donna. It's something that Seattle Insight Meditation definitely relies on, either volunteering in the form of Donna or financial donations. We have guiding teachers who whose livelihood depends at least in part on donations, and your offerings help support the Dhamma continuing forward for many, for yourself and many many people as it has for 2,600 years. So it's greatly appreciated. You can find the donate button on the SIMS website. And let's take just a moment to offer dedication of merit for our practice this morning. We dedicate the merit of our practice this morning so all beings everywhere, without distinction, can clearly see the nature of things and be free. Oh, where's my bell? Oh, I don't have it. Oh, well. Ding! Thank you, everybody, for being here. It's wonderful to have Sangha.